Hello, fellow homebrewers. JP here, and I want to introduce to you the brand new Brewbuilt X1 Conical Series available at More Beer. More Beer sells the highest standard in homebrewing equipment, and the Brewbuilt Conicals are just that. They're made from mirror-polished 304 stainless steel, and they come with loads of features that you and I have been looking for. They have a full 2-inch bottom dump valve, which will eliminate your clogging issues, while the sturdy base includes 4 reinforced legs, just like those big pro tanks do. More Beer also carries the Brewbuilt line of options and add-ons like casters, pressure kits, and even external glycol chillers. So you can find out more about the new Brewbuilt X1 conical uni tanks by going over to morebeer.com for detailed videos on the entire line of Brewbuilt conicals. You can trust Brewbuilt with your next fermentation, and you can trust More Beer to find the right conical for you. Brewbuilt at morebeer.com.
Great beer is about drinkability. Doesn't matter the style.
You guys are like walking beer Wikipedia.
That's the first time that you've ever accepted me as a person.
Or you have a fermentation in your gut.
Yeah. I'm jet propelled at all times.
How many guys do you think that you have the privilege to slap?
Somebody who's never tasted a commercial example, and this is how you know everything about this beer? Please, you don't.
I think it's bullshit.
I think it's bullshit too.
Wow. Are you guys going to arm wrestle?
No. We're going to teabag fight instead.
Yeah. You heard of Junkyard Wars?
No. Can I get another high five, Beavis?
Now, live from the Brewing Network studios in Northern California, this is the radio program for home brewers, craft brewers, beer lovers, and beer geeks. It's your only source for live beer radio that brings expert brewers together with, well, expert drinkers. This is the radio program with a head on it. This is The Session.
Hey, welcome to the show, everybody. It's The Session here on the Brewing Network. My name is JP, and today's show, pretty excited. It's a California show. From a brewery in Bakersfield. But before we get to that, of course, I want to thank our sponsor, More Beer. You can go to morebeer.com, learn about everything there is to learn and to know and to enjoy about making your own things at home. It's homebrew, and it's cider, and it's wine, and coffee roasting, and I don't know, probably metalwork. I'm sure you can buy some sort of lathe machine from them, too. I have no idea what goes on over there, More Beer. But they have everything you guys need to make good beer at home, great beer at home, cleaning supplies, draft equipment. Like I said, all the winemaking equipment you could ever shake a mash paddle at. I don't know. I'm confusing my metaphors. But anyway, today on the show, Temblor Brewing Company from Bakersfield, California, and we have Don Bynum on the line here. Don, welcome to the show.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited, man. You know, not only I love talking to California breweries, but in Bakersfield, I know literally nothing about Bakersfield. So I'm excited that there's at least one brewery. I know that there's several in there, too, I think Bakersfield is a... It's a big place. I think we always, maybe I'm in Northern California here in Oakley, and you know, we always just sort of like, there's the sign for Bakersfield, but when we're going to LA, I don't know what there is to do up there. I know you had a lot of country and Western music going on. I see you are on, what is it? Come on. I just was looking at it. Buck Owens Drive, Buck Owens Boulevard, is it?
Boulevard, yeah.
So it's like, there you go, some Buck Owens. I like some old-timey country. But, other than that, man, how did you end up in Bakersfield? Tell me a little bit about your time in Bakersfield. What's going on?
Sure. I'm born and raised, and so is my dad.
Nice.
Grandparents came from Oklahoma in the 30s and settled in Bakersfield. And Shafter, which is a small town outside of Bakersfield. My background, though, is my dad's a commercial real estate developer, and I was a property manager and a commercial broker for about 15 years before taking this project on. The unique part about the project is that it is in one of our developments. It's an old Home Depot-type building.
Okay.
And, yeah, so we took the corner, we took the garden section of that building and built a brewery. And
that's cool, man.
Yeah. And, but as far as Bakersfield goes, you know, when I was a kid, it was, you know, it was about 100,000 people, and we're sitting at about 500,000 now. So
wow,
it's grown dramatically. And I think we're number 9 on the list of California cities, size wise. I think just behind Oakland, actually. So,
and
Long Beach. Yeah.
Wow. And you guys are very spread out too, right?
It is pretty spread out. You know, downtown's just a couple miles over from where we are along mm-hmm. the 99. And then you got housing 15 miles in, you know, east and west. So, yeah, it's about 30 miles in diameter. And, yeah, very unique city. But the brewing industry, the most unique thing about Bakersfield is that we tend to get into trends late. And the brewing industry is a little smaller and further behind than other places of our size. We were only the second brewery to open, and we opened in 2015.
Wow.
There was Lengthwise opened in, I believe, 98. So they've been around, but they were by themselves for 17 years.
just the bullseye as big as the target at that point. And you're just like, this exactly. is it. We have, you know, 200,000 people at some point. I don't know.
Come exactly. So, yeah. So we love being, in Bakersfield. We love the culture of, old country and, being a part of that, and then being close to Los Angeles and, you know, the Sierras and the beach and everything. It's kind of like 2 hours away from most places, except 4 hours from the bay, so from where you are. So
yeah, and you know, but when you're making that drive down the 5, it feels like 5 light years away. You know, it's just it's soul sucking.
The other thing about the 5 is that I think Bakersfield's notorious for just being bypassed by the 5.
Yeah.
It's about 15 miles west of the edge of town. So
that's not too bad, you know, and I'm so guilty of it. I'm one of those drivers that like I gotta get to where I'm going. I barely will stop to go to the bathroom. You know, right. It's like, okay, we got to go, because even 15 minutes, well, I go, well, then that's 15 minutes back and then whatever. And then I can't do it. But now as I'm getting older, it's like, I would, you know, I'm interested now to see what's around me. I'm not so like nose to the dashboard kind of thing, especially driving, because you want to take a stop. You want to take a break, especially off that drive. That's just the worst drive in history, I think. It's because there's nothing going on, but I don't know. There's a lot of stuff spraying up. That's interesting, man. I think that's crazy. So you were the second brewery in town. How was that transition? First of all, from commercial real estate development to a brewery, was there something in between? How did you get mixed up in beer?
So I did. Me and a couple of friends opened a private bar downtown back in 2011.
A private bar.
Private bar, membership only.
It's like a social, like the social clubs you hear about in like the 20s and 30s. Okay.
Exactly.
Why is that? What can you?
I don't know.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Explain why we, you know, why we went forward with it even 10 years later. But
if Doc was here, he would say, because you could.
Yeah, because we could. It was, it's a tiny little thing. And it was, you know, it was like we thought to ourselves, if nobody ever joins up, at least we have our own little spot to hang out and have our friends over or whatever. And, but the thing that was really born out of was a trip to Belgium and Germany and experiencing the Belgian beer culture and Oktoberfest, and then kind of coming back and just, for me personally, becoming obsessed with homebrewing Belgian beers in particular. And it kind of was born out of that pretty quickly. Within 6 months of that trip. So
had you heard about homebrewing before?
Yes. Okay. I definitely heard about it. But until I experienced that kind of European, no matter what bar you go into, you know, everyone's just focused on the beer, you know?
Yeah.
It really like, you know, I hadn't even really been to craft breweries all that much other than Lengthwise at that point. And so it really opened my eyes. And, I was used to dive bars mostly. Bakersfield was, you know, mostly dive bars at that point.
Gotta love a good dive bar, man.
Yeah, just changed the way that I thought about everything. And so I became, you know, I started reading and experimenting and everything. So,
okay. So you went to Belgium, you're like, oh, my eyes are open. I want to come back and do this. I could do this. I'm a smart guy. I know how to cook stuff. I could do this, right? Yeah. How was your, and you have a homebrew shop in Bakersfield, I think, too, right?
We do. Yeah. Yes, we do have one. We had one in the past that that went out of business, but yeah, there's now 6 going on 8 breweries in town. Wow. Plus Kern River Brewing up the hill. And then we have a bunch of craft beer places now. And so the community's just exploded with craft beer in the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, that is like, that's like the big bang of craft beer in Bakersfield.
Exactly.
Where it's just nothing's going on before. What came before the craft breweries, Daddy? Nothing, son. We don't know yet. We're still trying to figure that out. So you're home brewing. Are you focusing more on Belgian beers because that's sort of what you fell in love with? Or are you focusing on, you know, the West Coast IPA? How long ago was this?
This was 2010.
2010, okay. So sort of after the West Coast IPAs have died down a little bit, or maybe not? I don't really remember.
Well, around here, I wasn't aware. So
okay. what kind of beers were you drinking beforehand, before you went over to Belgium?
I quickly took many trips to San Diego and, you know, went to Stone and Ballast Point and all those places. And
yeah,
but so I was making Belgians because I was so obsessed with, you know, the higher alcohol golden ale, like the Duvel or the Triple Carmelite.
Oh yeah.
Le Chouf is one of my favorites.
Once those get into your bloodstream, they don't leave. They just don't. And it's like you have like sensory, enhanced sensory memory when you drink those specific beers. I've never had them at the source. I've had like a super fresh West Vletteren 6 once. So it was like bottled 2 weeks, and it was like, will never probably happen again. And I still remember that beer, or at least what I think that beer was, right? But it's hard with, you know, sort of American craft beers to have that, but it's especially when you're first drinking, because these Belgian beers are so intricate. It's a Rubik's cube of flavors, and how do you unlock that? And they change, and if they sit out too long, then they change into this, which is still good, but it's not the same as this other thing. So you're trying to pin those down in your own home brewery.
Yeah, I tried, and
you do it. Doesn't sound like you did it.
Yeah, I mean, I did. I learned about sanitation pretty quickly.
And, yep.
And I was using iodine, I think, and I, you know, I learned over the years. I also tried to make some pale ales. They were pretty decent, but then I really got kind of going on. I bought a 5-gallon barrel, and started putting beers in that. So. Mm-hmm. Then I contaminated my whole brew system. Wild yeast. So I had some, you know, unique beers. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
I only bottle conditioned for the first 4 years. So that was one of my favorite parts was bottle conditioning and, you know, waiting for it to finish and all that. So
the anticipation of the build up to the hard work kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, I understand that. You know, I'm still thinking about your bar, though.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So whatever happened with that? Did people sign up? Was it a...
Yeah, so we got 55 of our friends to sign up on day one. And we wanted it to feel like a Belgian beer bar. So we really focused on the matching glassware, having the bottles ready.
Okay.
We made sure to have the perfect pint Guinness, and we had Triple Carmelite on draft from day one.
Jeez.
And then just a few other craft beers on draft.
Mm-hmm.
I had my full-time day job, and so my job was to show up at 5 o'clock on each Thursday and bartend until 9. And we had a rule, and then my partners would fill in the other days. We had a rule that you could have one mixer with your liquor drink, or because we didn't know how to make cocktails, so we weren't going to spend the time to figure it out at that point.
So you had a hard liquor too?
Yes. So that's the key element of the private nature of the bar, was that Bakersfield, I believe, still has a moratorium on new liquor licenses in the downtown core.
Hmm.
And so the only way to get a public liquor license is to take over an existing bar or to purchase the license from that bar. And that just almost never happens. So we figured out that you could buy one from out of the area and move it in as long as it was private. And so the specific license allows only, it's a club license.
Okay. So, I've never heard of that. Is the moratorium because there's too many bars down there even still today, or?
No, I think it's from many, many decades ago. I think it's just from the idea that we don't want any more bars in this area. And I don't think there's too many, especially now with the amount of people we have. So I think we got some work to do on that. So
okay, interesting. All right, that's cool. So is the bar still going?
It is. It's just celebrating 10 years, and we're actually working on moving it to a little bit larger location and in the next 12 months. So it does have a full time manager. I don't really have to, you know, deal or do anything on the day to day with it. So that's other than, you
perfect.
Know, show up every once in a while.
Yeah. Is it still private bar?
It is still private. Yes.
Okay. Would you want to give it a plug? You can give it a shout if you want.
Oh no, it's okay. We try to keep it,
On the down.
I'd love to have you there someday if you ever come to town.
I would love to go.
But yeah, we try to keep it a little bit secretive.
Okay. All right. So. Well, no one listens to this show, so it's fine. Okay. I like that, man. I think that's a cool idea. Now I kind of want to do that, but that sounds like a lot of money, honestly.
Well, there are other versions of this. I know there's one in San Diego at the top of a hotel. There's a couple in LA, I'm sure, and then there's certainly some in Europe too. So in New York City.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm sure the European ones aren't licensed because they just don't care. You know what I mean?
Right.
Okay, so you're home brewing. You got the bar going. You're working full time. You're a busy dude. What makes you want to become even busier and open a brewery?
Oh, man, that is such a good question that I kind of ask myself a lot, you know?
Yeah.
I just an intense entrepreneurial drive that, you know, just wouldn't leave me alone. You know, the living, wanting to be here, wanting to be in Bakersfield, and then still wanting so much more culture and other things that Bakersfield, you know, didn't have at the time or enough of. And so that's really what drove me. And then, you know, like the only being the second brewery around, just it felt like a good place to do this and get in on the ground floor of a movement. And so, yeah, that's really what drove me. But I still think back and I think, yeah, I was definitely crazy. So
most people are, man. Most people who come on the show go like, I don't know why.
Yeah.
You know, there's something that moves me. But other than that, like, it was stupid because I'm working a ton. But at the same time, I love it. It's that kind of like, that's that reoccurring thread through all of the shows we've ever done is just so that same sort of mentality, that same sort of mindset of like, I just had to do it.
Yeah. And I had people around me that, you know, wanted to do it too. And that's really, really what it boils down to, is having the support to be able to do this. We have 35 local investors who, you know, signed up pretty early. And I just felt blessed to have those guys. You know, because it wouldn't exist without them. You know, with the way that we built it, you know, kind of for growth versus being more conservative at the front end, is unique and, made things, pretty tough for the first few years.
How was the city in having you come in? I mean, they only had one other brewery. We've heard a lot of stories on these shows, over the years about cities just not fully understanding the needs permitting wise or just the needs in like sewer systems for, you know, for breweries. Did you have any pushback on that, or were they easy to work with?
So I work with the city quite a bit, you know, separately with in the real estate world. So I'd had a lot of experience with them, but not with the industrial waste department at all.
Okay.
And the city was fine. The health department was great. You know, we have a restaurant as well.
Nice.
But the waste department came in a little late on the need for wastewater, retrieval and treatment.
Okay.
And they came in so late that we had already built everything. So.
Oh, with here are the specs you're going to need to hit. And you're like, bro, we've already poured cement.
Well, they came in and said, hey, your building department approved your permit and you built out your brewery, but you forgot this part. And this is also required. And, you know, that was naive on my part to not understand the wastewater element. But lengthwise, the brewery at the time wasn't really being monitored. And they were a 15-barrel brew house. So I think the city kind of, you know, learned by us coming through and in. And then, you know, as subsequent breweries have opened, they've become experts now on what's necessary for breweries.
Sure.
And we have an above-ground tank system that hopefully will last a couple more years. But at some point we're going to have to probably go underground with it. So, that was actually one of the most difficult parts of the getting open part, because it was just we were just sideswiped by it, and it was expensive. It was very, it was just a budget number that we had not taken into account. So
good gravy.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to get open from start of construction to opening day?
So I think we put our business plan together in like August of 14, and I think we opened in September. Yeah, we opened September of 15. So about 13 months from.
That's not bad.
And that's the other thing. I did about 30 construction projects, or I managed about 30 construction projects prior to this. So it did give me kind of that experience to be able to like take the beating that it gives you.
Yeah, and, that is true. You do seem very sort of predetermined to be doing this for yourself, you know, because you get a lot of guys who come on like, oh, I was taxi driver, and then I threw a business plan together, and then it was all fucked. But sounds like you definitely could draw upon your past experiences and put something together that gets through pretty quick.
Without that experience, I would have felt very uncomfortable with this project, but it was still the most difficult one I've done. And the understanding a boiler and how it works and all that's, for a brew house and there's so many things to learn. There was a huge learning curve, and I feel very fortunate that I had that experience going, because I don't know if I would have survived otherwise. So.
Yeah, right. You had so much other stuff to learn. Was it you putting the entire brewery together? Like, did you quit your day job and focus just on assembling the brew house, or were other people brought in for that?
No, we had a general contractor, and we had the brew house was built by JB Northwest up in Canby, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a learning curve on the brewery being installed for sure. But we did have a head brewer on site who had 12 years of commercial experience at the time. Who came to us from Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
His name's Mike Lottie, and he's now back in Minnesota.
Okay,
getting ready to open his own place.
Nice.
He was here, and so he understood the inner workings and how to set everything up and all that. He'd worked at Harpoon for many years.
Mm-hmm.
So having him was an absolute must for us feeling comfortable as well. So
nice. Yeah, that's really important. And there's a lot of those guys out there that are just cruise around and open your brewery for you. Yeah. It's definitely important, because there's a lot that can go wrong. Think you know everything.
Brewer for 4 years, and he created some of our award winning beers and stuff. So
excellent. Okay.
Yeah.
So you opened in 2015. Okay. And how was the community reception to you guys?
It was wonderful. Yeah. It was really good. Bakersfield was actually known for just hammering new restaurants or locations to eat, just line out the door for like months and months and months.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. So, is it like a community support thing, or is it like there's something new?
I think
let's experience the new thing. Okay.
Both, but the excitement of something new is definitely a big part of it. We recently got a yard house. They're still experiencing that, I think. I mean, post COVID restrictions and all that, but
sure. Yeah, it's got to be hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. That's great. You had a big community rollout. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and we had this other group of people called Brick Founders. We took some bricks from a It just happened. It just so happened that there was a brewery built in 1918 downtown, and it got torn down like the year before we opened. So it'd been sitting there empty for, you know, decades. And so we took some of those bricks and we installed them in the brew house here, or in the restaurant up on the wall. And then we sold naming on the wall opportunities called Brick Founders. And so that group of people there's like 200 or 300 of them at that point. And those people were super bought in as well, and kind of the original support day to day.
Wow.
We needed them just desperately as well, because our budget, we went over budget. So
I'm shocked. I can't. I'm shocked that that happened. But you got through it. You're open. Did you have a kitchen up front?
What's that?
Did you have a kitchen when you first opened, or is that additional?
Yeah, okay. I had a kitchen up front. My partner, one of my main partners, Tom Maxwell, his dad owned a restaurant, local restaurant, for the whole time he was a kid, and he worked in there, and so he was kind of the restaurant expert. We kind of had experts kind of scattered around, you know, to help us navigate certain things, and mm-hmm. our food's actually like something I'm most proud of. And people, you know, it's good. People come here just for the food, separate of the beer. So,
wow, that's a good problem to have. I don't know why I said problem, but that's great, man. I mean, you don't want to be just one thing to everybody. You know, I think a lot of times people focus on the beer, and then, you know, we have like a, you know, sandwich if you're sort of hungry. But if you can do two things well, and people don't know which one they want to, you know, whatever. I think that's great.
Yeah, I mean, without the restaurant, there's no way we would have made it. So thankful for that.
Yeah, that's cool. What kind of beer styles were you focusing on when you first opened?
So we went with, I brought some cans. So we started with El Cerrito Mexican style lager.
I have that. You know what? I'm going to open it.
Oh, awesome.
It's a good time to open it. So you started with the Mexican lager.
It's a full-bodied Mexican lager. We kind of went with the Vienna lager, you know, real historical version before it got to Mexico type style. And man, we love this beer. Most of us around here, it's what we drink the most. And it won a U.S. Open gold medal back in like 17, I think.
Nice. Congrats, man.
So yeah. That was definitely wanted to start with a lager, and then we also wanted to start with the Belgian wit, the Under a Blood Orange Sky. And those are the two beers that are the same virtually.
Super clear, like crystal clear Mexican lager, man. Look, you can see my stupid face behind it, and the head's still going too. Well, tell me a little bit about the Mexican lager. I mean, you said you were trying to go for more Vienna style, which is great. What's your lagering time on these?
So we're actually, at this rate, we're lagering, I think, for 35 to 40 days.
Wow.
And okay. German lager yeast. So when Oktoberfest rolls around, this actually becomes my, you know, my German lager for the month.
Yeah,
and we get out the big mugs and all that. So, because it does remind me of, it reminds me of some of the great German lagers.
Yeah, it does, man. It's super malty and smooth in that way, but it does have some of the Mexican lager yeast characteristics.
Yeah,
it is in between. What made you decide to do that instead of just going pure, like, you know, Mexican style or pure Vienna style?
I'm always having to do something unique. I can't, that's really what it boils down to, is something that you don't get anywhere else, or that you can't find anywhere else.
Yeah.
Now we learned the hard lesson, that, you know, the beer did not do well in the marketplace, because people didn't really figure out what it was, you know, and, okay. And Mexican lagers around here are incredibly popular. Modelo is number one or number two beer, I think, around here right now.
With good reason. God bless Modelo.
Yeah.
That beer is so amazing. You know, the Negra Modelo is great. Just the classic or the Especial, I think, is the so good. It's just amazing beer.
So yeah, I mean, it's a long term beer. It did not, you know, it's actually doing better now than it ever has. And you know, you've got people up near you. There's a little place called El Cerrito, and those people are all over it. They like there's a guy that orders has a little. I can't remember what the name is, but has a little pub, and he orders like 5 cases at a time. And
wow.
So yeah, it's
nice,
it's,
man.
It's pretty cool. And it's, you know, like I said, it's the one that we love. It and Streets of Bakersfield IPA, I think, are the ones that we drink all the time. So
I'm about half a can in now, because I'm trying to really change the pH of my mouth, and really it's my first beer of the day. So I'm really trying to like get a grip on it. And it's an interesting beer, because it is sort of like there is an aggressive bitterness to it. You know, it's not overly bitter. I wouldn't call it bitter, but it's aggressive. It's forceful. It's right there. But it's like sort of at the end. I don't know. Sometimes when I taste things, I get like I don't know. Brain dead is one word for it. But I just get focused on like where to put if the beer I'm drinking was a timeline, where in the finish or where in the mid palate this one thing would be. And this is sort of like at the mid palate towards the beginning of the finish, if that makes any sense to anybody who's also brain dead. It's right there, and it sort of reminds you that it's an American style beer. It sort of reminds you that it's it reminds you that it's not Modelo. It reminds you that it's not just a Mexican lager. It's different. It is unique, like you were saying. It's sort of its own thing. I do like this beer a lot. There's a nice malt backbone to it. There's a little bit of bready going on, but not really. The yeast profile is heavy and focused, which it should be. This is a great beer. I like this beer a lot.
Thanks.
And so it was hard to, you know, for the local sort of to figure it out. Was that just through education that people came around and now it's doing a lot better? Or, you know, what do you explain that? Or how do you explain the, would you call it a resurgence? I don't know. I mean, people have opened up to it, maybe.
I think mostly the growth of craft in Bakersfield is really the big thing. I think craft here, I mean, if I had to guess, was 1-2% of the market when we started.
Okay.
And so when people were coming in, a lot of people coming in, you got Bud Light, you got Coors Light. You know, where's your light beer or whatever? And we're like, no, you got El Cerrito. Yeah. You know, that's as light as it gets. So we forced people to drink. El Cerrito when they came. And because they wanted light beer. And since then we've created a lighter beer. But
I was going to ask, if there was pressure to do that and how you reacted to it. Yeah.
Enough years where you're just getting hammered. Trial, you know, people tasting it or having to drink it while they're here, realizing how much they love it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then that's really what led to its growth. But it does get a lot of love outside of town and outside of the county. So it's just wherever the craft beer love is, I think it's more appreciated. So,
yeah, I can see that. Where are you distributed? You said you're up here a little bit, right? Up here in Northern California?
Yeah, we just started in Sacramento North with Sicani and just about 6 weeks ago. So
nice.
But they've done really well so far, and we're all over the place. Lake Tahoe, Redding,
okay,
Davis, Folsom, all those places. A little, you know, we're speckled around there.
Yeah, so, those are all, you know, pretty big craft growth areas too right now.
The Sacramento scene is, we spent a couple days up there recently, and I was just loving it. it's such a cool vibe up there with craft beer right now. So gives me some, you know, I think Bakersfield's on its way, you know.
It sounds like it. I mean, what you said, in 5 years there was like 6 breweries or
and
I
think we're probably 5 or 6% craft as a marketplace right now. Which is probably about half of the nationwide average. So we got a long ways to go, but we made a lot of progress.
You're getting there, though. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really great. What about craft beer bars?
Yeah, there's quite a few. Eureka Burger was mm-hmm. kind of one of the trailblazers.
Okay. Yeah, I think we have one of those up here, too.
Yeah, they're kind of a regional chain, California-owned chain, I believe, that is very, very driven to support local. And, you know, we've always, you know, that's where I was hanging out before. There in Lengthwise is where I was hanging out before Timbler was open. So mm-hmm. There's another place called Bootleggers. There's a couple of locations for Bootleggers here in town. They do a lot of craft beer. There's many others that are supportive as restaurants.
Okay. Yeah, but just the sounds like the craft beer bar scene has grown as well too. Which is sort of the delivery point to, you know, to getting to you guys, to coming in directly to you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yep.
That's cool. Yeah, what a great beer, man. And you know, and as it warmed up just a little bit, maybe some of the carbonation drove off, more of that sweetness came through. Yeah, I like it a lot. The El Cerrito, it's good. It's really good. I love that style of beer, and it's fun to see how much you can do differently with it and still keep it within a style. Because for me, it is a hard beer to sort of play with like that.
Yes.
You know, I'm a purist, and I don't want anything I don't want my pure baby to be touched at all. But, you know, you can kind of get away with it. What we haven't talked about, is the name.
Oh, of the brewery.
Timbler Brewing. Yeah, yeah. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Sure. So, it's... The word Timbler is Spanish for earthquake. I didn't even know that, you know, tremor and Timbler are kind of the same word. One's English, one's Spanish. There's a couple of things about the geography of Kern County and Bakersfield that point to the name. And, you know, naming a brewery even back then was incredibly challenging and
yeah,
and time-consuming, but my friend Garth Corrigan gave me a bunch of ideas, and that was one of them. And there's a mountain range on the west side of the county. Mm-hmm. On a clear day, you can see kind of rolling hills, looking in the direction of San Luis Obispo, Paso Robles, Santa Barbara, and so it's kind of in between the beach communities and here, and it's where the San Andreas Fault runs.
Okay.
So that's why it got that name, I believe. There's also a more historical perspective that we found on the internet one day, and this is after we named the brewery. And there's a place called Sharktooth Hill on the east side of town. It's a place where you can dig up megalodon teeth
wow,
and other types of shark teeth all over the place, and fossils. So you can actually find people out there digging all, you know, any day of the week,
just digging up the mountain. I love that's so cool.
There's like a band, and like, so there's like a trail right below it, and just people digging into the side of the mountain. Wow. Well, the reason that's there is there used to be an inland sea, mm-hmm. where Bakersfield is now. Mm-hmm. About, you know, a million plus years ago.
Yeah.
And it was called the Timbler Sea, apparently. So.
Oh.
So we're at the bottom of the Timbler Sea.
Yeah, you sure are, man. You sure are. That's a neat story. I like it.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. I like there was the sea there. That's cool. All right. Well, I'll tell you what, Don, let's take a quick break. We're going to get some more beers. We're going to come back. We're going to dive deeper into the beers, talk a little bit about what's going on. And you have some pretty interesting stuff. I was telling you before the show, I really appreciate you sent like a really wide variety of beers. So I think we'll have a lot to talk about. So hang on, everybody. We'll be right back with Timbler Brewing. It's the session. Don't go anywhere.
Segmented, demented, fermented. It's the session.
Hey, thanks for sticking around, everybody. It's the session. We're here with Don from Timbler Brewing, and I'm about to crack open another beer. Don, I don't know what to pull out. I have no idea. I have the Almond Brown Ale. but that might be a little too.
We want to do the blood orange, we could, Belgian red.
Yeah, let's do that. Under a blood orange sky. I love the labels, man. They're pretty slick.
Thanks.
I do like the back too. It's like nobody ever really looks at the poor back of a beer label. You know, because it's not a wine label. There's no story. Why the fuck would I? But it's, you know, you got a lot of information crammed in there into, like, I'm assuming just sort of leave the sides nice and clean, you know. And it's nice. It's cool, man. You got a lot of info there in a small space, and it's not just a design mess.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
I don't know why I felt I had to comment on that. okay. Let's tell me about Under a Blood Orange Sky, please.
Okay. Original recipe from the beginning. We basically wanted to make a traditional Belgian wit. And, you know, think Blanche de Brussels. There's several other Belgian wits that, you know, that I've had over in Belgium, but then we wanted to give it a little twist. And, so we added some, blood orange puree in there, and not a lot. So it's just a very small amount compared to some of the fruit beers that we're now producing. It's like 1% or 2% probably of that. So,
okay. Just a hint.
It's for a little essence. And then, you know, Belgian wit yeast is the most important shining star, I think, of this beer. There's all kinds of spice and fruity esters coming. I think depending on the age of the beer, it can kind of change. And, you know, some people talk about whether they like it fresh or a little age on it. Huh. But yeah, it's the Belgian beer we got away with producing. Let's put it that way, because we tried producing others, and you know it's not a widely sought after, you know, yeast style. So
true. It would be, I mean, especially if people are coming in and asking for light beers,
right?
It's a very aggressive yeast profile to kind of, you know, teach everybody about. And I don't mean to say that, like, you know, your patrons are you know, uneducated in the space, but you know there's some of that. It's not like a disparaging thing, but It takes a while for people to work up to a Belgian wit, especially with this many or this heavy of a kind of like a clovey profile.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's definitely, I can understand that for sure.
Which is why I was so surprised that it was our number one beer for the first 4 years.
Really? It was this?
Yeah, by far.
Wow.
It still is. For some reason, it's the beginner beer when people come here and they haven't had our beers or they haven't had craft beer. It's kind of the first choice, and you know, people tend to love it, even though it's got so much going on. And honestly, I think there's a lot going on with why that is, and I think it has to do with the other wheat beers in the wheat beers in the marketplace, like Blue Moon and Shock Top and things like that. So,
okay. Yeah. Those are, I've never had Shock Top, but I've had Blue Moon. It's fine. It's a fine beer, but it is sort of on the sweeter side.
It's very much on the sweet side. And I don't think there's any true Belgian yeast in there.
No, I would be surprised. I would be shocked.
But you know, I mean, I've always, that's just confusing everybody. So I definitely wanted to use the real thing, and I'm glad we were able to do it. And then to get the bronze at the GABF was just an absolute shocker. I mean, it was amazing. So,
yeah, that's great. 2019, congrats, man. That's cool.
Thank you.
I love it. Yeah, that's a good beer. Again, it's very yeast focused, sort of like the El Cerrito. Is that sort of a conscious thing? You guys are trying to push more character from the yeast? Or just how it ends up when it's, you know, in the tank, done and ready to go.
Well, I think on Belgian beers especially, that's why I fell in love with them, is that intense yeast. And then, you know, I mentioned German lager yeast also. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think when it really boils down to it, I'm a yeast lover, and then also a hop lover. and then but then it kind of went in that order, and
yeah,
and you know, the malt is holding everything up, you know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it explains why you fell in love with beer, I mean, if I could say that, in Belgium.
Yeah.
It makes total sense.
Yep.
You know what I mean? That the yeast would go first. Yeah, I like this beer, man. It's not, you know, overly sweet like we were talking about with like a Blue Moon. There's a lot of yeast character to it. I don't know that I would have picked out the blood orange on my own, because it is sort of subtle. But blood orange does have a kind of a bitterness, so, and this beer has a kind of a bitterness to it. So I would have just assumed like, oh, it's just sort of like a slightly more bitter take on a Belgian wit with like orange peel or whatever. But I like the fact that it's not that. You're using an ingredient that pretends, but you can pass it off as some other aspect of the thing. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And I think that's cool. I like it when beers can be subtle like that. And then once you know that it's blood orange, you go, okay, now, of course, I'm an idiot for not seeing that beforehand. Why? How could I be so stupid? And I will never drink again. It has a great aroma, too. I mean, you get, I think you get some blood. See, and this is the problem, is once you know there's a thing in there, that's all. It's like, of course, yeah, I can pick that out.
I can definitely pick it out.
But I don't know that I would have beforehand.
A couple years ago, we made a double under a blood orange sky.
And okay.
We handpicked a 500 blood orange tree, or 500 pieces of fruit off of a tree.
Oh my God. Why? There's puree for like, that. What are you doing?
Like, let's have a big fun day with it.
And okay.
So we did that. We peeled them all. It was ridiculous. It was such a mess.
Yeah, bro.
We boiled it off. We added it in, and it was you want to talk about some blood orange flavor. It was intense, but it kind of taught me what blood orange really, really is. And then, you know, you can really pick it out just subtly. So,
yeah, definitely. Yeah. I like the beer. It's very good.
Thank you.
Where do you add the blood orange in the process?
We add it in the mash, I believe.
In the mash. Okay. Is it a puree? Or you're just using...
It's a concentrated puree, I believe.
Yeah. Okay. And you're doing it in the mash. Wow, okay. Yeah. How come not, you know, later in the process?
You know, I can't answer that one, honestly. Okay. I think that was...
That's fair.
I did give Lottie, artist, touch, if you will.
Okay,
I wasn't pushy about, like, you know, certain things, and that definitely was his decision, and... Now later on we got pushy, but
well, when
it came to IPAs, but
it's always going to happen. No,
yeah. So these first two beers are definitely his originals, and, we've not changed them at all. So,
well, it's good. I mean, there's no reason to. I'm just curious, you know, for some reason, the past few shows we've had people with like doing pineapple.
Oh yeah,
and it's like pineapple in the secondary, and it's I like to talk about where things get added, because it does make a difference on impact,
for
flavor
sure.
impact, and what you're trying to achieve.
Absolutely,
you know, that's the thing, and so yeah, just curious. That's cool, and then wow, I can't believe this was your number one seller for basically your entire time you've been open. What unseated it? What finally took it over?
Streets of Bakersfield IPA.
Okay, figures. Yeah. I don't know why I had to ask that. I should just assume.
Now the lagers are both lagers are starting to kind of take it over also.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
You've seen a big push in lagers.
Well, we're seeing a lot of growth in both the lagers, actually. Yeah. So,
nice.
And I think that has to do with the distribution, and we're also in Los Angeles, in the Los Angeles area. Or the whole basin and Orange County, down there. So we've got lots of stores taking these on, and
that's good. Well, yeah. Lagers are hot right now, man.
Yeah,
you know that's what I want to drink.
Yeah, I think they're gonna be hot forever. So
I hope so. I really do. But you know, told me 5 years ago that there'd be a lager resurgence, I would have laughed at you.
Right.
Hopefully it never goes away. But, you know, the downside of lager season is that it's celebration season right now. So that's basically all I'm drinking until, like, you know, February.
Yeah.
Then I'll come back to, you know, to anything else. Okay, what do we got here? What's the next beer before we take a break? Streets of Bakersfield.
Let's go Almond Brown.
Almond Brown. Let's do it.
In the order of session versus.
Let's do it. All right, tell me about Almond Brown Ale, please.
So Almond Brown is one of our newer products. I believe it was born in 19. And it was a unique project that was a collaboration with some local almond growers that approached us and were a member or were participating in the California Almond Board's leadership program. So their idea was to make a beer, of course.
Sure.
The whole idea was how do we promote almonds and more than they already are. I mean, such a huge product, but especially here in Bakersfield and Kern County, we grow an unbelievable amount of almonds, just unbelievable. So, this was another beer created by Lottie, you know, before he left us, but we all kind of, were passionate about IPAs also at this time. And, so we decided to dry hop with almonds, with locally roasted almonds.
Dry hop with almonds. Okay.
Yeah. So basically this has,
I never thought I'd hear that sentence.
Yeah, the guys bring us fresh almonds and then we chop and roast them ourselves in the kitchen. And then we put them into the mash and then also into the finished beer. This is a English brown with English ale yeast. You know, the beer itself is what you'd expect of an English brown. And then, you know, the almond roastiness really takes over. So, yeah, this beer is actually growing faster than any beer right now, probably. I think Sacramento is loving it, and but the almond people really support it also all over the state. They're really passionate about it. And
I just think of like 6 foot tall almond people walking around. I've been watching too much South Park, I guess, so it's just like, we are the almond people, drink our beer, it comes from us.
Yeah. And then this one won in the nut beer category of the U.S. Open this year, won a gold medal.
Nice.
So,
excellent.
Yeah, so it's got a nice medal under its belt.
It's a great beer. And I know I've been saying that a lot, and it's sort of like I'm pretty limited with my you know, my good or great or wow. I'm the Owen Wilson of the beer tasting world, I suppose. But it's a very good beer. And again, it's a beer that sort of can be a lot of other things. If you told me there was coffee in here, I'd be like, yeah, totally. I get that. Like a medium roast. Excuse me. Also very phlegmy. I don't know why. it's like if you told me like a medium roast, like Kenya, or maybe even like a Sumatra, if you want to go a little bit. But it's just, if you told me that was in there, yes. If you told me that you put a little bit of cacao nibs in there, I would have said, yeah, I could sort of see that too, because there's a chocolatey thing. And then I go, I would love to see this on like aged like 3 months on cacao nibs, or maybe a little bit of like, you know, chocolate or some lactose in it. And you make sort of like that, a couple places like on the East Coast do like a coffee with milk beer kind of a thing to mimic that smooth richness of a milk coffee, you know, whatever. This is like one of those substrate beers where you can sort of do a lot of things with, because it's so complicated and it has a lot of, like on a spider graph, right? It would have like a lot of peaks in a lot of different areas on the wheel. And I think you can play with those and accentuate some things depending on what you add to it. I think this is a beer that you could really have a lot of riffs off of, because it is so flavorful and it's very good. This is an excellent beer.
Well, I think, thank you. And I think we're probably going to try what you just said. So
should
we have a, we have a one barrel system and a three barrel fermenter that we'd like to strip off and do, you know, goofy things with, and then put it on tap.
Nice, dude. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and we just pulled cacao nibs out of a beer. So we'll probably try something like that. That sounds really cool.
It's yeah, this is great, man. Like, you know, I don't know. It's sometimes I wish I could just remove my brain and like upload it to the metaverse so everybody can, you know, understand what I'm thinking without me having to strain my brain to figure out words for it. But it's like, it sort of tastes like there's a milk, like a lactose thing to it, because it is smooth and there's like a light brown sugar, like a muscovado sugar. I'm just gonna be really bougie for a second. I've been doing a lot of baking, Don. Okay. It's my thing. It's like a light brown sugar note in there. You know, it's almost like rum like in a way. You can sort of get those like aged rum notes to it. Just, man, what a fascinating beer. Yeah. Great.
Thank you.
Great. I'm gonna give some away to some of my Dr. Homebrew friends, Dr. Homebrew judges. We do a judging program just on homebrew. People send us beer, and we talk just like this, but with their own homebrew, and give them feedback. And I think this would explode their mind. How does this do? So you said it's you know, sort of growing, but this is not a light beer. You know, this is not a Belgian wit or whatever, a Mexican lager. Like, it's very, very flavorful.
But it is light. I mean, it is 5.0.
Yeah.
So it's sessionable. And I mean, you definitely can drink a couple and not feel overblown.
Trust me, man. That's one of the reasons why I love it so much, because I'm a very like big low ABV guy.
Yeah.
Because I love to drink. I just don't want to get drunk.
You know, the farmers were, you know, let's make a big old crazy almond beer. And we're like, do we want to sell this beer, or do we want, you know? So, yeah, we were very focused on having a sessionable product that we keep around. And it wasn't planned to be year-round, but it has now pretty much become a year-round beer. So,
I can definitely see. I mean, I can also see you imperializing this and putting it in a barrel for 6 months.
For sure.
You know, like a bourbon barrel, or, I mean, you could even probably do something fucking weird and, like, you know, talk to a distillery, putting like gin going into barrels is sort of like a thing. Take a barrel like that that had some gin in it, but I don't know. That might be botanicals might be a little too pokey. I don't know. But yeah, you could do a lot with this. I wonder if you could even do some like wine barrels, like a white wine barrel or something.
Ooh.
You know what I mean?
You just brought something up for me. Like one of my favorite products that we make, and I should have sent this too, but is a Chardonnay barrel aged Belgian amber, strong amber beer, basically.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite. It's one of the few beers that I made at home that I was like, I love this beer. And but so yeah, the darker malt, or the medium tone malt sugars with the Chardonnay flavor is quite spectacular.
Yeah, so. I would definitely get that. This tastes great. I don't think I can say enough good things about it. I no wonder it won a gold. I mean, it should have won 2 golds. It's that good. I really enjoy it a lot. And I sort of don't want to, like, you know, talk about anything else. I just want to keep drilling down into like the flavors, because it's so complicated. And I'm excited for you guys. I'm excited for the beer culture in Bakersfield, because this is a popular beer. We've had some breweries on where it's like, yeah, here's this, you know, beer that we really love, but like people don't really gravitate towards it. And, you know, it happens. It depends on where you're at, or maybe the education, or maybe it's like having a successful band. It's like just timing. It depends. You could be the greatest band in the universe, but you might not have that heat. And so I think it's really neat that there's a beer like this that people are embracing, because I'm sure that it gives you sort of the courage to branch out a little bit more and to try other funky stuff.
Absolutely. And I would say that, you know, it's especially shocking to see a brown ale, you know, have some popularity, because you know, a couple of years ago, I would have put that at the top of the styles that don't touch that style, you know, right now.
Yeah. Well, we used to have a thing on the show, several years ago, where it was like, I think it was, Sully from the 21st Amendment. I think that was him, or it was Vinny. I can't remember, but they were like, basically, no one buys a color. So any beer that you name a color, it just no one's going to buy it. Not like red ale, no. Red IPA, eh, maybe, because IPA sort of makes up for a lot, but like brown ale, not really. Blonde ale is a whole different like thing, but yeah, brown ale, I think, just in and of itself didn't sell, except for beer nerds like us.
Right.
You know? So, yeah, that was the other part, too. It's almond brown ale.
Streets of Bakersfield IPA?
Let's do it. Streets of Bakersfield IPA. We'll do that. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll drink the other beers and talk a little bit more about whatever we want. It's my show. I can do whatever I want. Streets of Bakersfield. All right. Tell me about your IPA, man.
Okay. The IPA is the most chaotic of our brands.
What?
from a historical standpoint.
Okay.
I think it's the fifth or sixth version. We all, you know, fought a lot about this beer.
Wow. That is hoppy aroma, man. Wow.
One of my favorite breweries at the time, you know, when we opened was Stone Brewing and Sculpin, obviously, Sculpin IPA. You know, I knew that we had to have a classic West Coast IPA. And so that's what this is trying to be. And we had a lot of growing pains with it. But, you know, learning to dry hop properly and with quantities and all that took us years. And I'm proud of that we got there. Our brew team now is completely made up of homebrewers, local homebrewers. So, but yeah, this is, I think it's 2.5 pounds per barrel dry hop with Matueca, Citra, and Mandarina Bavaria hops.
Those first two, sure, understandable. Like the third one, Mandarina Bavaria, I would not have, that came out of left field for me. You surprised me with that one.
Yeah. And I think that's left over from earlier renditions. You know, Mike Lottie, God love him. He's not an IPA guy, and he wasn't making West Coast IPAs really before he came here. So, we all fought through this together, and that's where it ended up. And we all drink this just all the time, and it's our number one product by a pretty good margin at this point. Yeah. So,
I mean, I think I see what you mean about fighting through it, because to me this doesn't seem like a beer, and you know, I don't mean this to sound, you know, stupid or whatever, but it doesn't seem like a beer where you build on paper and you go, this is what I'm going for. It does seem like a beer built from experimentation because of the Mandarin Bavaria. Because it seems like almost like a softer mouthfeel, almost like a hazy, but not that, you know, cloudy, pillowy nonsense, right? It's the water profile is a little bit rounder, it feels like to me. There's not a whole lot of like upfront bitterness per se. I mean, it's bitter, but you get so much of that flavor with that soft water profile. It drinks sort of like a hazy that's not trying to be hazy, if that makes any kind of sense.
Okay.
But it's so, there's so much flavor in there. Like this is almost overwhelming. And I don't mean that in like a negative way, because I don't want you to change anything about it. But it's like almost like, wow, I need to, I don't know, I need to sit here for a second and just sort of like absorb it, you know? Because like a lot of IPAs, especially nowadays, they can be sort of funky, or they can be one thing or another, or it's like, you know, it's like here's one, it's two row and a billion hops, and it's like it's too bitter for me, or it can be too complicated where you don't really pick up any hop variant. And that's not what I mean. This is none of those, but it does feel like a beer that was fought over, for sure, if I can steal a line from Sierra Nevada. You know what I mean?
Yes, please.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another thing I mentioned is one thing that we fought a lot about was the caramel malt element. And I think we ended up with, there's still a little C20 in there. But okay. If some people had their way, we would have stripped it out. But I love having some malt, some extra malt in there to back up those hops. And having a really well-balanced IPA with regard to the residual sugar, and not just having this kind of flat malt bill where you can just, you know, where all you get is the hops. I mean, that's really what I was wanting. And so I think that's, so I fought hard to keep that C20 in there.
You know, and I think you were right. And I sort of fall in line with that too. Like, I'm not an IPA drinker. I've tried to brew it like a couple of times, and I can't brew pale beers. I don't know. I'm more of a stout guy anyway, and a porter guy, but I like a little bit of the C20s. I think it's totally fine. I mean, there's IPAs are, it's hard to get a consensus on what an IPA should be.
Yeah.
Especially nowadays with the hazy IPAs coming through and just, I mean, you know, literally clouding everything up. But, so, yeah, I can imagine, especially if you have a bunch of homebrewers trying to tell you what they think they should do, because it just, it's impossible. And so I think you were right to fight for that. I mean, it's your brewery. You do what you want. This is the beer that you want. But I do like a little bit of that crystal malt in there. Not too much, because to me, it sort of separates it a little bit from just being hop water.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And I got to mention, this year, our 6th anniversary is a double hazy version
of this beer.
Yeah.
I'm glad you didn't send it to me, but no, I think that's cool, man. I think it's neat because, you know, again, it's sort of the hop profile is sort of like a hazy beer in that way. It's like tropical-y, you know, mm-hmm. Overripe mango kind of a thing. But that Mandarina Bavaria to me is like light, like high citrus, almost like white wine kind of thing, which is a little different in an IPA. And I can taste it a little bit. And again, I don't know how much of that is actually my brain working or me just inferring from what I think I know about that hop, but it adds a little bit of a different finish at the end, which is cool. It's a cool hop profile.
Thank you.
What yeast do you use on these?
That's Kal-El yeast.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice clean.
Just for the streets of Bakersfield, I believe, yeah. Mm-hmm. We use something different for the hazies.
Sure. How many different yeasts are you working with in there at Temblor?
Well, less than we used to. We started out with a Kolsch.
Wow.
As a year-round, and it died off about 3 years in.
That hurts me. I'm sorry.
I know.
My condolences. I love a Kolsch. That actually is sort of surprising. Like, the Mexican lager stayed on, but the Kolsch didn't. I mean, I feel like that's more in between like a light beer and a Mexican lager. It would be a Kolsch. I mean, don't hold me to the fire on that, but sort of.
Yeah, I think unfortunately the Kolsch style just was, it was kind of like, you know, don't make a brown ale. I mean, I think it got worse after we opened. I think people were like, oh, Kolsch, I don't want that, you know.
Interesting.
I don't know. It was weird to me. It was one of our top threes that we started with. We named it after our area code even.
Wow, what other brewery does that?
I don't think you guys have heard of that one.
No, who does that anymore?
But did you know that ours used to be 805?
Did it really?
It did.
No.
Yeah, and 805 is the number one craft beer in Bakersfield by, you know, many, many, many times over.
Sure. I mean, you can only, you know, once you hit the lotto, you would try to replicate it as many times as possible. I don't know what that means. Right. Yeah, I wonder how it would do now. Kolsch. I mean, because, you know, it rides that line. It's that hybrid line.
We still have a bunch of cans, so we'll probably try it again, you know, a small batch here or there.
Cool.
But, so these last two are like, if you thought the other beers were flavorful.
I'm looking forward to them, man. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back, and I definitely want to open those. I'm excited about that. So far, I like everything, man. You know, the IPA, it's a 7%er, and it doesn't taste like it. the you know, I'm sitting here letting everything sort of like hang out on my palate a little bit, and it's still just sort of like drinking the beer. The hop profile is super mellow but intense. It's not, like I said, it's not overly bitter. It's not aggressive. It's not grassy. It's not cat pissy. It's not all these things, right, that you can sometimes get at IPAs. But it's a very just nicely well done flavored beer that doesn't taste like it's trying too much.
Awesome. Thank
I like
you.
It. Yeah. So hang on a second. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with Don from Tembler Brewing in Bakersfield, California. We got two more beers to drink. One's bottled. I believe it's a Flanders, and I'm pretty excited about that. And then we'll wrap things up. So hang on, everybody. It's the session. We'll be right back.
You're tuned into the session.
Because life's too short to listen to crappy radio.
All right, thanks for sticking around, everyone. It's the session. We're back here with Don from Tembler Brewing in Bakersfield, California, right there off the 99 on Buck Owens Drive. Boulevard. Thank you very much. Just the Buck Owens sticks with me. I don't know why. Keep going back to it, man. Pushing that Bakersfield sound, baby. You gotta love it. Is country and western, country and western, god damn. Is it still big down there? Are you guys, you know, sort of like thriving off of country a little bit?
Absolutely, yeah. I'd say about half of the pub shows we have here are have some element of country. There's a couple of bands that are really focused on the old school country.
I love it.
It's really cool.
I do like a lot of country, man, or old country. And I don't know why that's like not new country, but old country, you know, only one song about my truck. Yeah, it is really different. It really is, man. And, it's almost like what a lot of like old country, well, I mean like Buck Owens and, Merle Haggard and whatever, they were like rallying against like the Nashville sound of like everything's too polished. It's almost like what's popular now. Mm-hmm. Is the sort of the same like thing, and then you know Hank Williams III is doing his best to bring back the outlaw country. But if you're into the country, which sounds like you are in the old country, there's a podcast I will recommend to you. Which even though we already talked about, neither of us have time to listen to podcasts. It's called Dollar Country, dollarcountry.org, and it's this kid who just he's you know a man. He just digs for like old country like 45s. And plays from like artists that you've generally never heard of, and it's like from like the 40s and 50s, and it's pretty cool. It's a cool little podcast, Dollar Country. Yeah, check it out, man. It's neat. Yeah, kids are real passionate, and it's good. All right, speaking of good, we have Key Lime Pie Kettle Sour, brewed with graham cracker, lactose, and vanilla. I feel like I'm interviewing a different brewery. Yeah. Who are you? Yeah. What brewery are you from? Because this is not
a brewery from the pandemic.
Tell me about this, man. This sounds amazing.
Okay, so it's a series that was born with Ruby's Boysenberry Cobbler. So I just got to throw that out there.
Okay.
Because Ruby is my grandmother.
Nice.
And she made cobbler.
Of course, you have to.
At every you know family get together.
Yeah.
So. This was the second rendition. I'll run you through it. We do a 48-hour kettle sour with lactobacillus. We boil, and then we do a primary fermentation, and then we load with just a ton of key lime puree from Oregon fruit, I believe.
Okay. Make good stuff.
Yeah, and secondary fermentation at that point. And then... In the finish, we add lactose, vanilla. I'm sorry, the graham cracker goes in the mash. So
okay,
it's pretty cool how it comes through, in the aroma and the flavor, even though it's in the mash. So so that's kind of how we do these beers.
It does carry through, and that's one thing I noticed when I took my first sip. It was that graham cracker sort of thread in between all the flavors, like a sandwich, like a reverse s'more or whatever. That's interesting.
And this one is especially acidic, I would say, because of the key lime.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other ones, you know, the boysenberry, you know, is much more balanced.
Okay. All right.
With the kettle sour. But some people just go crazy about this beer. And I think it's our highest rated beer right now, which is just insane.
I couldn't, and this is a good thing, I couldn't pigeonhole you guys if I tried. And it sounds like your customers can't either. I mean, this is your highest rated beer, and you have a Mexican lager sort of dominating things, and then you have a wit beer that's really dominating, and you have you have a lot of different stuff. You have lagers up and coming. It just sort of it feels like you're really stretching your brewing, and it sounds like the community is sort of with you on that vibe too.
Yeah, yeah. I think so. But again, the pandemic, a silver lining in the pandemic was certainly this line of beers. Also, just the mixed berry creamsicle just came out. This is another line.
Man,
it's ridiculous, right?
It is.
If you had asked me if I'd be making the beers like this, I would just, you know, a few years ago, I would have said, no way, you know, but.
Well, what changed? We, you know, we talk about the pandemic changing things like that. How did the pandemic shift that into the boysenberry creamsicle or where the.
So there's, yeah, the pandemic was a big element, but the other big element was a new head brewer. And Justin is, you know. Justin and the team, I should say, we were all very excited to just get out there and start experimenting and doing some crazy stuff. Survival was part of it, mm-hmm. you know, doing things that would entice your non-traditional beer drinker, I think was a big part of it. And, you know, not things that I, you know, would make at home, you know, for myself, but
yeah,
you know, we're
that's okay.
The biggest thing that I learned in this business is, you know, if you're going to survive, you're going to make beers that people want to drink and buy. And if you don't do that, you won't survive.
Yeah. And it's interesting because you said that, you know, you're making beers to entice new beer drinkers. And I feel like with those beers, I'm always of the impression that breweries would be targeting existing beer drinkers who like that. I don't really look at is it a hazy beer? I mean, it sounds like a hazy beer because it's creamsicle, but it's describe the beer for me.
The creamsicle is much like this, except higher alcohol, no kettle sour.
Okay.
And no graham cracker. So vanilla, lactose.
Okay.
Tons of fruit.
Okay. Still. Then just with a little bit of more knowledge, I can move forward with my stupid, boiled brain thought. But it's like, I would automatically assume that like, oh, you're always going to be marketing to existing beer drinkers, but not new people with like sort of a funkier beer that stretches the definition of a beer or, you know, whatever, maybe that's hyperbole. But, I thought it was an interesting point to sort of touch on that to maybe target people who haven't had beers or who aren't craft beer drinkers or whatever. I think that's something I can take away from funky beers like what you're describing.
Yes. Yeah. I think, you know, we're thinking about converting people more than other places because, like I said, we're behind the game.
Mm-hmm.
Behind the eight ball. One fun note, the first one we made here was a raspberry creamsicle. We'll get back to the key lime, but
yeah, for sure. Trust me, we're getting back to it.
I saw like women that I know from like business and stuff. I saw mm-hmm. they would just during the pandemic, they would come multiple times a week and buy that beer. And I never seen them step foot in the brewery. So, it did its job in, you know, getting people to try some people that wouldn't drink our other beers or say, I don't like beer or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, getting them in the game. So,
and is the pandemic part also sort of, how can I put this? Sort of calling on the community to support the local brewery no matter what. And here's an opportunity for people to do that. Cause like out here, you know, in the Bay Area, that was definitely a huge part of why I was drinking beers that I wouldn't normally drink. is to sort of just help, like, okay, I can, first of all, this brewery can deliver beer to me. That's great. I'm going to do that. Let's just stretch out a little bit. Let's try this, or let's get a little bit more of this other thing. And it sounds like these beers can sort of be that for people who aren't necessarily really craft beer drinkers, but do want to keep their local place in business.
Absolutely. I mean, we had a tremendous, for the first six, I would say 6 months of the pandemic, a tremendous outpouring from the community. The real tough part was after that, when everything was like, where are we now?
Yeah.
You know, we still had lockdowns going on. You know, we had that January full lockdown thing, which was the craziest part for us. But wow. These beers, you know, we went down to no kegs, as I'm sure you know, everyone did. But so these canned beers, especially in the LA area, were kind of like saving us. And, wow. You know, having new products at that time was just a godsend. I mean,
cool.
That's all anyone wanted was a new product right in the middle of the pandemic. They wanted something exciting and new, you know?
Yeah, which sort of echoes what the beer drinker sort of wants anyway, but I feel like the pandemic sort of accentuated that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. And it's kind of snapped back in many ways now. So it's very interesting. Like, you know, kegs are back in a big way. So
you pushing more draft?
Yes. Yeah. I would say more than 50% draft at this point. When we were like last year at this time, wow. We were like 0%. So
that's wild on so many levels. Playing. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really wild, man. Yeah. This Key Lime Pie Kettle Sour, man, that graham cracker, I'm surprised at how much of it comes through. I mean, there's a cinnamon aspect to it, and I would think that the cinnamon would sort of get washed through and not really be as prevalent at the end, but it's right there.
Yeah.
It is up front. Yeah, that smells like opening a package of graham crackers, but like good graham crackers, you know what I mean? Not like the Nabisco ones where you're like, ah, okay, whatever. I don't know. I mean, maybe you use those. I don't know. But it's somehow like focused everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why. It's just that graham cracker's red. Yeah. I could just smell this all day, which makes for boring radio, but you know, what are you going to do? Yeah. You know what? And like you said, it is very tart and a lot of it is a lime thing, but Kettle Sour does pretty good too. I mean, I like to think I can sort of figure out, you know, the lime aspect, but where the kettle sour part ends and the lime sort of begins, but not really at the same time. It you do a really good job. What I've noticed about all your beers is you guys do a great job working with the ingredients, making sure that nothing is really sticky outy, nothing pokes out, nothing is too obvious. Everything sort of works together and blends well together, and that's not an easy thing to do.
Thank you.
Yeah, how does the key lime pie sell for you guys? People love it.
This series does it's consistent. You know, there's a fan base, you know, that probably just drinks just this stuff.
Just, you know, no. Of course, there's just people who are just drink kettle sours and that's it. Yeah.
It's definitely not like on the drink list for many of the employees, but you know, sometimes we like to mix and things, you know, give little elements of grant, you know, things like that. And
I would float a little rum on this if I was at home. With actually, I am at home and I have more of this. I'm gonna float a little aged rum, maybe a little Kirk and Sweeney 23, man, just bloop right on top.
Yeah,
round it out.
That sounds great.
That's what I would do. you know what we haven't covered, man, is, and I apologize, what size is your brewery? How many barrels are you working with?
Oh, yeah.
What are you guys producing? So
we're a 20 barrel brew house with the one barrel on the side. We're gonna be somewhere in the realm of 2,000 barrels this year.
Pretty good.
We were 16 and change last year and 13 and change in 19. So
that's nice, steady growth, man.
Yeah, we got some steady growth, and
I mean, if you're growing nowadays, you're doing really, really well, I think.
Yeah,
yeah, we're, that's great.
We feel blessed to be growing. There's, I mean,
yeah,
And we've got space to do 4,000 to 5,000 barrels. So, you know, if we ever get up there, it'll probably be pretty chaotic. And but, you know, we can feel comfortable between where we're at and where that's at. So,
yeah. All right, Flanders Red. Talk to me about Flanders Red, please.
Okay, so we have a sour brewer. His name is Sean Van Sickle. He is well known in the homebrew community, and has been working for us for many years. And actually, most recently, has become a sales guy. But we gave him rein over a barrel program in the back. He brought in his proprietary yeast blend that he retrieved from Belgian bottles. Okay. Cantillon, I'm sure many, some of them, you know.
Yeah.
And brought that in. And so what this is an 18-month-old recipe that he put together that was in barrels for, I think, about 12 months.
Okay.
So we start in, and these are, you know, 1 to 2 barrel batches that we're doing, hand bottle condition. And then, you know, aged in the bottle for a few months to finish off. But, you know, I'm not a huge sour, you know, traditional sour drinker, but I appreciate, you know, what Cantillon and breweries like that do. And I thought that this Flanders was spectacular. And we actually sent this in the GABF.
Yeah.
went for something, but we didn't get anything. But,
oh, damn. That's all right, man.
But this is just one of like 5 or 6 bottled sours that we have right now. And this is like the one that we have that's traditional, I would say.
What kind of barrels are you putting this in?
I believe this is in a red wine barrel.
Okay. Yeah. It definitely, I picked up on something that wasn't just like pure beer.
Yeah. I get a little red wine.
Yeah.
And that's probably why we didn't get it. but one thing I would mention is my background is in wine, as far as tasting and drinking goes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, my dad's a collector. He's been collecting Napa wine since before I was born. So once I turned 21, I got exposed to all the great wine that California and France have to offer.
Wow.
And it was just... it's an unbelievable education that I received, and pretty odd for my dad when I wanted to go into the brewing business. But.
He's probably hoping to get like an inside foot or a foot in the door of the next collection, man.
No, but I mean, so yeah, my background is in more subtle, you know, wine aroma and flavors.
Yeah. That shit's hard too. Like wine tasting it can be challenging, you know, because even, I mean, beer can sort of withstand a little bit of oxidation, like in the glass when you're drinking it or whatever, you know, it's like we off gas and, you know, has that layer of protection, but wine doesn't. And it just, but some of those like basic, like flavor descriptor bases, you know, like leather, they can translate, but it's that branching off that really changes between beer and wine. You know, it's not an exact one for one. So yeah, it's a good foot in the door of like how to approach a glass of a thing, but after a while you're on your own.
You know, we have a couple other beers that are just like, god, it's almost like you're drinking a white wine, aged in a Chardonnay barrel, you know. So I mean, this part of the business is definitely what kind of fun, cool stuff can we come up with. It's not here to, you know, to try to sustain the business. You know, it's here to experiment and, you know, really get out there. But these beers are very out there. So,
yeah. How do people react to this? How does
that's the cool thing. We have a steady flow of people drinking these, mostly at the pub.
Okay.
And they, you know, they sell for 10 a bottle. And
it's a good price, dude.
I'm always pleasantly surprised that they continue to, you know, have some demand. And it hasn't always been the case. I think we figured out some things along the way, but he was working on many of the beers that we have now for, like I said, about 18 months, 2 years. So,
okay. Yeah. $10 a bottle for this is a very, very decent price. Yeah. Because there's a lot, again, there's a lot here. It doesn't fall apart in any sort of, I apologize, my fucking throat, dude. I'm a phlegmy mess for some reason for the last like 2 months. It's annoying as hell. But anyway, it doesn't like fall apart after, you know, any certain amount of time. Sometimes Flanders, especially, like, I'm not a giant fan of the style because it, for me, it's a very finicky style to pin down. You can either get so, you know, acetic where it's like nail polish remover, like Duchess de Bourgogne or whatever. Yeah. I've had so many bottles of that beer where it's just like I'm just drinking nail polish remover with like a little bit of sugar, and it's too much. And then on the other side, it can be a little too sweet and not. Flanders Red is for me a very hard style. The Rodenbach, I don't really like Rodenbach. So for me, I'm not really exposed to it. But the styles that I've had or the examples that I've had aren't necessarily. I don't know. Interesting. But this is like, it's like a focused version of a Flanders Red where it's very, very intense. The beer character is very, very intense. The sour is maybe a borderline for me too much, but it works so well with like those darker cherry flavors of the malt and the beer itself that it's like, it's okay. So for me, it like pushes the boundaries of a Flanders. It's like a bigger Flanders for me.
Yeah.
But it still, again, like everything else, it sort of works together. And I couldn't imagine what it would be if you like backed off on a little thing. Like it would be really hard to tweak this beer. It's sort of, I think it is what it is, and what it is, it's a very good beer. It's very, very complex, very, very robust. Cherry pie doesn't really even do it justice, although I would put this in my cherry pie. I would make a cherry pie with this beer because it is those dark sugars with that sour. Get some sour cherries, that nice crust. I'm getting fat for days, dude.
Oh yeah, that sounds good.
If you never made a sour, if you've never made a cherry pie with a sour beer before, I highly recommend it, especially
okay.
Something like this.
Yeah, I haven't done that.
It's great. You know, it's.
I think for a Flanders lover, I think it's exciting. It is an obscure style that a lot of people wouldn't touch. So
no, and even for a non-Flanders lover like myself, it's a good beer. But yeah, if you like Flanders, if you like these kind of sour red beers, you're drinking this all day, especially for $10 a bottle. $375.
Yeah,
yeah. Up here in Northern California, it'd be $15, man, and worth it still. So I think it's a good deal, personally. I don't know why I'm harping on the price. But, yeah, that's very good. It's very, you got your dark fruits. You got your sweetness. You got your sour. It's almost like a dill pickle thing, which I know sounds gross in and of itself. But with it, but all you beer drinkers, you know what I'm talking about when I mean. I'm not literally saying dill, but it is that sour, like almost that salt and vinegar push, but that the malt character underneath it. Rounds it out and makes it make sense. So it's I would say it's very, very complex Flanders Red, but it works really well, and I wouldn't imagine this any different. I like it.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, Don. Well, I think I've taken up enough of your time on a Monday, so I think we'll let you go. We're going to end the show here. We're going to wrap everything up. But where can people learn more about Tembler Brewing Company?
Check out our website, temblerbrewing.com. We have most of our information is on Instagram. We have Tembler Brewing, and then we have Tembler Brewing Events. We have world-class comedy shows, concerts here at the brewery all the nice. Time. And we just had Kevin Nealon of Saturday Night Live a few nights ago. That was one of the highlights for sure.
Nice, man.
Yeah, if you're ever in Bakersfield, check us out. We do have live music Fridays and Saturdays and many Thursdays now. All local artists. And Yeah, we're just we're trying to promote the culture of craft beer here in Bakersfield, and we're loving it. So,
yeah, sounds good, man. I look forward to getting down there.
Yeah, let us know, and we'll meet up.
I will. That'd be cool, man. I appreciate it. All right, everybody. Thanks a lot for tuning into the session. I really appreciate it. Thank you to our sponsors, More Beer, and everybody else you've heard throughout the hour and a half here. We appreciate you guys supporting us and supporting them as well. So until next time, everyone, we'll see you later.
JP's an asshole. Justin's a nice guy and winning the race. JP does great as his charity can.